Dog Works Radio is sponsored by Alaska Dog Works. Check out their website at alaskadogworks.com.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto for Dog Works Radio, and today you're listening to our mushing radio segment with our co-host Alex Stein, and we're talking about what we're calling the new Iditarod. We're talking about three items in the news today. We're talking about the purse, sponsorships, and the new drug testing rule. Here is the show.
Dog Works Radio Network presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to Mushing Radio here on KVRF 89.7 in the Matsu Valley. RadioFreePalmer.org is our live streaming site, and you can find all of our episodes over on Apple Podcast. Just search for Dog Works Radio. We're also on social media as well. Just search again for Dog Works Radio. And calling in from California is our co-host for our Mushing Radio segment. His name is Alex Stein. Alex, how's it going?
It's going great, Robert. It's, we're having some wildfires here in California, especially up in Northern California. But I've been watching people posting and watching the weather reports, and it looks like there's starting to be a little bit of snow here and there in Alaska and some snow in the forecast. So I am hopeful, as I think most of our listeners are, that it's going to be a really good winter and we'll have a lot of snow for the races this year.
You know, I'm looking forward to it. It is pouring down rain right now, but the snow is coming down on the mountaintops, as they call it, termination dust here. And I've seen all over Facebook and the Mushers pages that people are out and about with their dog teams and getting ready to prepare for this upcoming season. For folks that don't know, in the early part of the training season, from about mid-August till sometime between Halloween and Thanksgiving, all of the training takes place on some type of wheeled apparatus, whether it be a training rig or cart, an ATV, a side-by-side, or possibly even pulling small cars like Volkswagens and cars without engines and that sort of thing. So people are getting out there, and a lot of people are getting excited for this year's race. It's going to be coming up real quickly. We're about 5 months away from Iditarod and just a couple of months away from the qualifying races that come up. And I do see, Alex, that a lot of the the normal names in mushing have already signed up for a lot of these shorter races like the Copper Basin and the Connect 200 and races like that. So people are back in the mushing groove, aren't they?
Yeah, they really are. And, you know, we've talked about this a bunch in the past, but these shorter races, a lot of them are qualifying races for the Iditarod. And when you think about it, if you're someone who's looking to run your first Iditarod, you have to complete a bunch of these qualifying races. And when the veterans are out there getting all of the spots or a lot of the spots in some of the qualifying races, it can become very difficult for people to qualify, especially, you know, as has been the case in the past few years, when there hasn't been as much snow and some of the races have been canceled.
You know, what I did find out, Alex, is I was looking on the Copper Basin 300s, either website or web page, the other day, and that is a race that typically fills up within minutes, along with all of the other races that that go online sometime in early October. And they were announcing that they still had five open spots for their race. They typically have a 50 team field, and they had not filled up as of a couple of days ago when I last checked. That is pretty unusual. Typically, a lot of these races are not only full, but they have substantial waiting lists by this time.
Yeah, and, you know, we've heard lots of mushers talking about how they a lot of the races do their sign-ups electronically now, so they go online and they're, you know, hitting refresh all the time like they're trying to buy concert tickets to try to get into and registered for these races. So if there's a little bit more room in some of the races, that's a good thing for all of the mushers who've been feeling like they've been shut out from a bunch of races in the past few years.
Right, right. So before we jump into today's topic, and we have a lot of Iditarod news to talk about today, I wanted to talk to you a little bit, Alex, about an upcoming segment of our show here on Mushing Radio that you're working on that we're going to start recording sometime next month and release it around the first of the year. Do you plan to, or can you share a little bit of a teaser with us, what's going to be coming up, and how are you going about it?
Sure. We're going to be covering the 1925 Serum Run, and we're going to talk about it from looking at the different segments that were run in the Serum Run. And I think a lot of our listeners know in general terms about the Serum Run, but we're hoping to we're going to get into a lot more detail and hopefully have a very entertaining series of segments on this and give you guys some stories that you might not be familiar with, even if you are familiar with the Serum Run in general.
And we're going to release it serial style. It's going to be more of a story series versus what we normally do here on the show where we talk about news and things coming up. This is going to be, you know, something that you can listen to on episode one. It'll carry you through several episodes, and it's going to be really important for folks that are planning on listening to start with that first episode where we talk about, you know, the lead up to the Serum Run and how they first get started on the trail and as they make their way down the trail and eventually finish in Nome. Is that right?
Right. And, you know, we usually do this at the end of the show, but let me just urge people, if they haven't already done so, to subscribe to this podcast. And that way you'll make sure that you'll be getting all of them automatically downloaded in your Apple Podcasts or whatever other podcast delivery system you use, so you will definitely not miss any of them when you subscribe.
And just a little bit more housekeeping in regards to that. Since you and I attended the podcast movement, I guess it's festival or conference or whatever it was a few months ago, we've made quite a few changes here on our broadcast. We've definitely reached out to different segments where we can host our podcast or at least land our podcast. Not only are we on Apple Podcasts, we're on Stitcher, we're on Google Play, we're fixing to be on iTunes and Spotify and all sorts of other places where folks can find our show. And what I think is really cool about the new hosting platform that we're going to is now you can listen to our show over on all the social media sites right from the site itself. So on Facebook, you can see a picture of the episode that we have released at that point, and you just tap on the picture, and you can hear that right on Facebook or Twitter or YouTube or any of those other platforms. I think that's a great way to have our listeners be able to find our show. Do you think so?
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, it just looks a lot better than it used to look. So we used to post links to it, and the links looked okay, but they look really fantastic now. And so when you see a link either on Facebook or on Twitter or Instagram or anywhere else, you can just click right on it and listen to it there. So we're doing everything we can to make it really easy for people to listen and enjoy the show and share it.
All right, so let's jump into today's topic. I'm calling this sort of a question. Is this the new Iditarod? And I know that you have quite a bit of insight to this in terms of reporting that you've done or evidence gathering, I guess it would be, on this. We're going to talk about three particular topics. We're going to talk about the purse of the upcoming Iditarod. and its requisite payouts to the winners. We're going to talk about sponsorships of Iditarod and a brand new rule that went into place, I guess it was earlier this week, with a drug testing rule. So let's start with the purse and the payouts. What do you have for us, Alex?
Yeah, so it was announced recently, in the past few days, that the Iditarod has said that they are lowering the amount of money for the purse substantially in 2018. So last year it was lowered by about 5%, but it was supposed to be around $750,000, and it ended up being, I believe, in the neighborhood of $710,000. This year they're saying that it will be $500,000, which is about a third less. So that's a considerable drop. And in order to do that, one of the things that they're going to do is only the top 20 teams will be what we refer to as in the money. And it used to be, for the past 15 or 16 years, it was the top 30 teams. And that doesn't mean that if you're 21st, you get nothing, because the Iditarod changed the rules a while ago so that everyone who finishes will get a token payout of $1,049. But it used to be that the purse would be a certain amount for the winner and then go down a little bit for each place until 30th place was around between $1,200 and $1,800. And now that $1,200 to $1,800 level is going to be for 20th place. So not only does that mean that there are 10 additional places that are only going to be getting the $1,049, but it also means that if you're finishing in 20th place for the past 10 or 15 years, if you finished in 20th place, you would get somewhere around $10,000, between $8,000 and $12,000, depending on the year. But now, if you finish 20th place, you're going to probably get about $1,500. And the difference between $1,500 and $10,000 is really something that could mean the difference between being able to make running the race viable for a kennel.
Right. You and I talked a little bit about this yesterday, and I had said that at our kennel, we have 40 dogs in our kennel, and it costs about $2,000 a month just to feed our dogs a race type diet, which is meat and a little bit of supplements and kibble. And by eliminating that amount of money from a prize purse, a team that is a solid middle of the pack team with a kennel about the size of ours is literally losing half of their potential food budget for the year. I think this is a really big deal, and it's really big news for the mushers, because, guys, you got to remember that in recent years we've had 70, 80, 80 plus teams entering into the race. Now we're only paying out the top quarter of the race, and we talk a lot about on this show about the middle of the packers, and typically the middle of the packers have been that 20th to about 40th or 50th spot in the race. Now two-thirds of those teams are not even in the money anymore. I think this is a really big deal. What do you think, Alex?
I think it's a big deal, too. The Iditarod Trail Committee has said that the past few years they have actually been paying out more money in terms of the purse than they've been taking in. So they've been depleting their reserves, which is never a good idea for a business. And so one of the reasons why they're doing this is to try to build their reserves back up so that, you know, as the normal business environment fluctuates and the normal year-to-year fluctuations occur, they would be able to be a little bit more stable. But it is something that is going to really make a big difference for a lot of people who run the race, and I think people who have been running it every year might think to themselves, well, maybe I'll only run it every 2 or 3 years, just because it's it's so expensive to be able to run the race. So I worry about that. The Iditarod has said, though, that if they get more money and if they are able to attract additional sponsors between now and the beginning of the race, that they would increase the payouts. This is a big deal to basically get rid of a third of the amount. And I was looking at in the Alaska Dispatch News, there was a chart in Tegan Hanlon's article, which appeared a couple days ago, and it said that the top purse year was 2008, when it was $925,000, and it went down a great deal in 2011, 2012. Then it has gone back up and has been fairly steady around between $700,000 and $800,000. But to drop down to $500,000 is just a long way from $750,000.
And, you know, this, I think, has a lot to do with our next topic that we're going to talk about in terms of sponsorships. But up here in Alaska, we had a booming economy in the mid to late 2000s, when most of the country was in the grips of a recession. We were doing very well, but then just in the last couple of years, a heck of a lot's been happening up here in terms of oil prices and lots of folks being forced to move on and they lose their jobs. So our economy is a lot like how the rest of the economy was 8 years ago. Now we're kind of dealing with that now up here. And just in kind of a gauge of that, in the last few years, our permanent fund dividend, it's a check that every Alaskan gets every October, has been cut in half. We used to get somewhere around $1,500 to $2,000 per year for everybody that lives in Alaska that is eligible. And now for the last couple of years, that has now gone down to just $1,000. We got $1,100 this year. So I think that that's a real good indicator of the economy. And I think that that's what the Iditarod is feeling as well. But there's also some other issues that come into play with some of these big sponsors that are leaving as well. What do you have on that?
Yeah, so there has been, throughout the years, there have been some animal rights activists who organize and try to stop Iditarod and try to get sponsors to pull out. And there's been a really determined effort this year to try to target people writing and calling in and targeting the Iditarod sponsors. And several of the larger sponsors have pulled out, including Wells Fargo a few months ago. And this worries me, frankly, because one of the things that happens is if there's less money from the sponsors, there is less money available for the purse. There's less money available for, running the race and sending people out and paying the pilots and the Iditarod, paying for the fuel for the Iditarod Air Force and paying to send out people to set up checkpoints early and things like that. And the Iditarod has announced that they are cutting back not only in the purse but also in staff salaries and in some of the money that they're spending on putting the race on. So it seems as if there's either a real money problem or there is the potential for there to be a real money problem. And, looking at this as a fan of the race and looking at the way some of these animal rights groups are targeting the sponsors, it makes me think that we as fans and we as people who are pro Iditarod should be doing more to reach out to the sponsors and thank them for their support of the race. We talked yesterday a little bit about how a lot of times people, it's human nature. We don't contact someone to say that they've done a good job. When we want to contact someone, it's usually to complain. And so I think that if we could, as Iditarod fans and as people in the mushing community, make a concerted effort to reach out to these sponsors and tell them how much it means to us and how much we appreciate them supporting mushing and supporting Iditarod, I think that would be a big help.
You know, I know we had talked about this as well. I always compare and contrast Iditarod with other sports, and we talk a lot about how it's sort of in comparison with the other major sports here in the United States and the NFL in particular, and sort of the politics of the sport that they're going through now with the national anthem and all of the domestic violence issues and all the things that are happening in the NFL. Well, this animal rights thing has always sort of been on the back burner with Iditarod, and it's always kind of been sort of a low-key problem, so to speak. But now I think that this is the new politics of Iditarod. I think it has a lot of folks talking about it. I think it has a lot of reason for changes and rethinking of things. I truly think that this is the new Iditarod and the way that they have to show themselves to the public and to put up a heck of a good public relations campaign to counter a lot of this quote-unquote politics of running the Iditarod sled dog race. What do you think about that?
I am totally in agreement with you. And if I were one of the people on the board of the ITC, or if I were advising them, I would very strongly be in favor of getting a bunch of the more well-known mushers, you know, the Seavies and the Jeff Kings and the Martin Boozers and Didi Genros and Ali Zirkles of the world, as well as some, you know, younger up-and-coming mushers, get them to do short videos showing them with their dogs, showing them, you know, taking care of their dogs, interacting with their dogs. I think a little bit of, in our modern social media world, a little bit of positive video, even if it's just video that someone takes on a cell phone, can be shared and can make an enormous impact. And frankly, I think that is one of the things that the animal rights activists are doing a lot of, is they have footage of, you know, of dogs being mistreated that is then, you know, taken out of context and shared all over the place. And what I would like to see is some video that shows really the top people and some of the best practices that we have in the sport, and use that to counter what's being done by the animal rights activists.
And what's curious, Alex, up here in Alaska, where, of course, mushing is frequent news, not only in the print media, but also on the radio and on television and whatnot, there hasn't been much of a counterbalance on that from Iditarod itself. You see a lot of discussion going back and forth about sort of this politics of Iditarod now between the individual mushers and the teams and, you know, sort of the participants of the race. But you don't see a lot from the corporation side of it or the business side of Iditarod. And I guess it's just one of those things where, you know, they're choosing to pick their battles. And I can understand that. You can't please everybody, and, you know, in any business, there's always going to be a side of society that does not agree with your principles, whatever they may be, whether it's the folks that don't like to eat at McDonald's all the way up to why people don't buy Fords over GMC or something like that. It's just interesting how they aren't saying a whole lot about it.
Right. And I think that is not so much a problem with the Alaska-based companies that sponsor Iditarod, but some of the companies from outside, the companies that aren't based in Alaska, I think they would be much more susceptible to public pressure. And so targeting those companies, I think, would be very beneficial.
And that goes right back to what we were just talking about with the economy of Alaska and sort of the recession that we're going through. It would be very difficult to attract major sponsors like some of these big boys. You mentioned Wells Fargo and Coca-Cola and some insurance companies and that sort of thing that put quite a bit of money in the race who are outside or out of Alaska. I know that a local bank stepped up into that banking role that was vacated by Wells Fargo, but I don't know. I know that there's still quite a bit of money here in Alaska, but from the sort of the middle tier businesses here, I think that there may be a little bit of a tight fist on the pocketbook.
Yeah, and, you know, hopefully Alaska's economy tends to trail the economy of the rest of the U.S., so hopefully you know, relatively shortly that things will start to pick up there.
Right. So let's jump over to our third topic of the evening and what we're calling sort of the new Iditarod. The 2018 version has a heck of a lot of rules coming down the pipe, a lot of changes, not necessarily rules, coming down the pipe since the last race in March. It was just announced this week that they are going to do mandatory drug testing with a whole plethora of conditions with it. And I want to talk a little bit about each one of those and sort of my understanding of them. And then, of course, I want to end the show with getting a fan's perspective of this from Alex, because I think that's very important, because not only is this a competition amongst, you know, 70 or 80 teams on, you know, one of the most difficult trails and events, sporting events in the world, but it's still a very fan-driven sport. And of course, if we didn't have our fans and our volunteers and our supporters, I don't know how much longer this could go on. So let's jump into this. Alex, what do you have to report on this new drug testing rule, and how did it come into effect?
Yeah, so very recently, the Iditarod announced that there was a team where there were multiple dogs on the team who tested positive for one of the banned substances. They didn't say which team it was, and they didn't say which drug it was. But apparently, and I was not aware of this, and it actually is a little bit surprising to me, but apparently the 2017 rules didn't allow for a team to be disqualified or penalized for positive drug tests for the dogs unless they could prove that the musher intended to give the dogs a substance that he or she knew was prohibited. So they have since changed that rule for 2018. So if a dog or more than one dog tests positive for something, then for a prohibited substance, the musher would be called before a review committee and have to essentially show that the positive test was not anything that was controllable by the musher. And people have talked about, well, you know, there are steroids, topical steroids, that are legal to use on a dog's paw, and the dog could potentially lick it, and that could cause a positive test. Also, people have talked about most of the mushers will send a lot of food in drop bags to the various checkpoints, and people have said, well, you know, the drop bags basically just sit there in the open at most of these checkpoints, and if someone wanted to tamper with them, they could potentially tamper with them and put something in the food that was prohibited. So there's been a lot of concern and outcry against this. It honestly never occurred to me that someone would try to tamper with food in a drop bag before. But I believe Mitch Seavey, who's one of the musher representatives on the ITC board, was saying that this is a possibility, and that this is maybe putting too much onus on the mushers. It's a very strange thing. In most sports, if you test positive for a prohibited substance, you're disqualified or you're banned or you're penalized. It's a very big race. So they test, I believe they test all of the dogs before the start. They do random tests during the race, and then I think they test the top 20 or top 30 teams when they finish in Nome.
You know, this is a real quandary, in my opinion, Alex. And the things I want to bring up are, number one, I know it's been talked a lot about in the last few days on comment sections of the newspaper posts and, of course, on social media about antibiotics getting into the dog system from the raw meat. Most mushers feed beef of some sort to their dogs as a substantial part of their diet. And we all know that most of the feedlots in the United States give cattle or beef, the beef producers, antibiotics to facilitate the growth of those animals. So that could be a potential way that this banned substance could get in. The next point I want to make is there's just so many banned substances on the list, so to speak, for dog mushing. It includes everything from, you know, as you mentioned, topical or anabolic steroids, all the way down to things like Advil and pain relievers and that sort of thing you cannot give dogs. So I think that it would have to be a pretty far-reaching test in order to test for all of those things. The next point I want to make is the collection method itself. I've been involved with sort of understanding and seeing how they do that at different parts of the race, mainly at the restart in Willow. And the way that they collect these urine samples is they just take a sandwich baggie, you know, a plastic sandwich baggie, and attach that to the penis area of a male dog, and then they put some type of elastic material and just catch the urine as it flows into this bag, and then those bags are somehow tabulated and then sent in for testing. Very unlike how a human test is done, where it's more of an evidentiary procedure where it's collected, it's put in a cup, the cup is screwed on, they put a piece of like a security tape or something on. It's a very controlled collection method, unlike what I've seen with how they collect their samples in the race and during the race. And my next statement is, my understanding is they're going to do another check about two-thirds of the way into the race, and they are going to be able to send these tests down to a lab. I don't know if it's in Anchorage or outside somewhere, and they hope to have a response back within 24 to 72 hours. That seems very unlikely to me, where they could do 1,000 drug tests in a matter of just a couple of days before the race is finished. So what happens afterwards? We talked yesterday about sort of the Lance Armstrong effect of this, where, you know, maybe years could go by and then people are disqualified or banned from the race like he was. How is that going to have an effect on the race? And probably the most curious part of this rule is now it's all on the musher to prove that there was no intent. And they're even going to use a polygraph test to the mushers to approve lack of intent. And that just seems very archaic to me. Very few jurisdictions use polygraphs for much of anything anymore. They are not upheld in court. So it just seems interesting to me, if a musher was banned and he took a polygraph and failed that test, and then he took a court action in a court of law, how would his appeal stand with that evidence? It just seems very convoluted to me, and something that's going to be very difficult to uphold. I do know, Alex, that there are other race organizations that do drug testing, and one in particular is the International Federation of Sled Dog Sports, and they have sort of independent testers. We were going to have a international race up here in February, and one of the conditions was they wanted to send a drug tester or a kind of an overseer of the testing, one from Japan and one from Norway, and our club was going to have to pay for it, and of course that wasn't in our budget. So we had to decline the conditions of being able to put on the race. So if it's being tested by Iditarod, I think that that's a different can of worms altogether. And, boy, I just tell you, I know that's a lot, but I just don't think it's going to be something that's going to be easily enforced. At least that's my opinion at this point. What are your thoughts?
I am absolutely in agreement with you. There are just so many details that will have to be worked out. The ITC sometimes gets criticized for not being very transparent about these things, and they have their own way of doing these things, and they try to put, you know, a common sense approach to this. It seems to me like there are so many things that possibly could go wrong, and my guess is that it's going to take them a couple of years of sort of trial and error to figure out how to implement this in a way that makes sense, is practical, and is fair to the mushers, because we all want there to be a level playing field, and we don't want anyone to be able to, you know, take advantage or have an unfair leg up or a way of beating this. But it seems like this is going to be a lot more complicated than it has been in the past, and you know, I think they're going to have to really tighten down on how they do the chain of command, chain of evidence for the collections. I think they're, you know, some of these tests, if you do them very quickly, there are tests that have a lot of false positives, so they're going to have to do a bunch of retesting for some of the positive tests. And it seems like this is going to be a lot more complicated, and it wouldn't surprise me if it takes 3 or 4 years to figure out how to do this well.
And, you know, we're not talking about drug testing of individuals at a place of business. We're talking about 1,000-plus dogs, typically tests that are happening in very adverse conditions, potentially by very tired volunteers or test takers, I guess is what you would call them. It just seems to have so many ways where this could go wrong. And, you know, it's just very interesting to me how they have the person and their team that was positive, and they didn't take any action, but they were so quick to take action on the musher that had the iPod shuffle or whatever it was a couple of years ago, and they immediately disqualified him, no questions asked. At the checkpoint, they pretty much said, pack your bags, you're done. But now something as major as this, they, for one reason or the other, and of course it's speculation on my part, is they just sort of swept it under the rug, and I think that that's really interesting.
Yeah, you know, and they said that it's for privacy reasons and that they weren't able to prove intent for it, but it, you know, it kind of puts a whole shadow over the race to have potentially a drug problem with the dogs, and I would think that would be something that they would want to go out of their way to clear up so that people can be sure that the dogs are not being helped by any of these banned substances.
And, you know, what's interesting with that, and maybe this will get me in trouble, I have no idea, but we had said that it was just the top 20 teams that were tested at the finish, and I don't know exactly where the positive happened, and I don't know the time that these particular substances stay in the body. But if it was a top 20 team, that was obviously a big-time team. It was not, you know, a middle-of-the-packer sort of just working his way, his or her way down the trail. This was a very competitive team, and they decided to do nothing against it. And the reason I bring this up, and I'm sure you remember this, Alex, I do not remember the musher's name, but I remember a few years ago that a musher was either disqualified or banned or some type of legal consequence because he tested positive for marijuana, and they took legal action of some sort after the race. But the important part of that is he was a very down in the list, middle to the back of the packer, and he faced a very stern consequence from that. Whereas this individual, who was a very competitive team, it was cited that nothing is going to happen because of privacy issues and they cannot prove intent. I just think that that is a little fishy to me.
Yeah, you know, it used to be, until relatively recently, they did not drug test the mushers at all. They would drug test the dogs, but I believe they just started drug testing the mushers in 2011 or 2012.
It was quickly where there was a problem. This individual was sanctioned in some way. Do you remember if it was a fine or a ban or a DQ or something? I just don't recall all of the specifics of it, but I do know that there was action.
Yeah, I don't recall the specifics either. I think it was a ban or maybe a temporary ban.
Right. Very interesting stuff. And as I am dubbing this episode and sort of this the new Iditarod with all three of these very important aspects of the race changing in the off season, I think that that's a pretty interesting development for our race up here in Alaska. So my last question to you, Alex, is what is a fan's perspective of this whole drug testing thing? I know you had mentioned that we want everybody to be on a level playing field, and I know that I talked yesterday to you about, you know, there's always talk in the other sports, like I said, we like to compare and contrast, where people don't necessarily care if you know, steroid use or drug use is happening in sports because they want to see exciting sports. And if you recall back, you know, a decade or so when, you know, sort of the steroid era of baseball was happening and people were just knocking balls out of the park and, you know, home run records were being shattered and all of that was going on in the steroid era. And people loved it. People were filling the stadiums and, you know, it was just a great time for baseball. And now that sort of has an asterisk to that era in sports. But at the time, people didn't seem to care because it was happening to some pretty big-name players, and they were doing some pretty amazing things on the field. What is your opinion if that were to occur in mushing, where, you know, things like this were to happen? Because as we mentioned with the Lance Armstrong era in cycling, you know, he was caught for it years later. His titles were taken away. But there has been plenty of information out there that said, you know, he was just the one that got caught. That type of drug use or blood doping in that sport was rampant and just about everybody was doing it. But it was a much smaller sport, kind of comparing to Iditarod, than the other sports like football or baseball or anything else in this country. It didn't have the profile of these other sports. So long story short, or long opinion short, what are your thoughts from a fan's perspective if there becomes a problem or sort of an understanding that there's a problem in Iditarod with these banned substances?
Well, first of all, the entire idea of having to worry about this makes me very sad. I like to think of the Iditarod as being a relatively pure sport, and I know that that's probably a little bit of a romantic way of viewing it, but I like to think of the Iditarod as something that is not subject to some of the same things that you know are problems in the big name sports. That being said, I think there's two areas where if this is a problem, it's something that will need to be looked at very carefully, and the first is at the very top, because when you're talking about the top five or the top, maybe even the top 10 teams, if you can do just a little something, if you can get maybe a 2 or a 3% increase in performance, that could potentially mean the difference between coming in fourth and winning the race. So it worries me that there would be people potentially at the very top of the sport who would, you know, want to have that little artificial boost so that it could push them over the top. And the other place where I think we have to worry about this is the people who are in the middle and looking to make a big jump and move up. I don't think it's going to be as much of an issue with the back of the Packers and sort of the middle to the back of the Packers, because those are, I think those are people who are generally just happy to be there and to compete and to finish the race. But if you're talking about someone who's, you know, who has a top 30 finish or a finish in the 30s that they want to get into that top 20 and get into the money, I would worry about someone thinking, well, maybe this is a way to get that, you know, to get that extra 5% performance increase on my dogs. So I think it's going to be something that is going to have to be very seriously looked at and thought about by the veterinarians and by the people running the ITC. And I think that they're going to need to come up with some system that will reassure us fans that that there's no doping going on.
Right. You know, and one of the main reasons why I've dubbed this sort of the new Iditarod, it is definitely changing relatively quickly. We talked last year about the cell phone rule and the coaching rule, so to speak, that came into effect during last season's off season, and, you know, went into effect for this past Iditarod, and how we thought at that point where if coaching was allowed, it may change. It may be a game changer on the trail where, you know, some of these top teams that have more freedom with their resources could send people down the trail and they could report back to the musher and say, okay, the trail from Ruby to Galena has a lot of overflow. You know, there's this and that on the trail to watch out, sort of a heads up, where a team that did not have those resources would not have the benefits of that sort of thing. So I think, Alex, that it, unfortunately, times are changing in just about everything in our society, and includes sports like Iditarod. I think that, you know, the romanticism of the early days of the race are changing very quickly, and new issues are coming up every year that have to be dealt with. At least that's my opinion.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, up until a couple years ago, I don't think any of us really gave much consideration to the idea of there being violence against any of the mushers. And then we had the attacks on Jeff King and Ali Zirkel, and that was completely shocking to most of us. So, you know, there are just things that we don't think of as being issues, and then when they come up, we realize that they are issues, and we or the ITC rather has to find a way of dealing with them.
Right. And, you know, no, don't get me wrong, Alex, drug testing and issues has been a big issue, the testing issue or the banned substances have been a big issue ever since I've been involved with mushing since the early 90s. I started mushing in 1994, and every mushing event I've ever been to, there's always some type of talk, some type of list, some type of rule in place where if you're caught with any of these substances, there will be consequences. So it's definitely not something new. It has been going on for decades. And it's just interesting how this came about sort of all of a sudden with Iditarod and you know, sort of the breaking of the news with a team testing positive. I would imagine there are many teams out there that use some type of an advantage, unfortunately, whether it's known or unknown. It could just be, you know, giving their dogs, you know, a pain reliever for a sore shoulder, but that's a banned substance, you know, just similar to any other sport. So I think that it's going to change the way that mushers run their race for the good. It's going to be a heck of a lot more oversight. And I also think that there's going to be a heck of a lot more control by the mushers and their teams with making sure that nothing that they do makes them a target or to be banned or disqualified or anything. So I think this is good and bad, but I do think that that there's going to be a heck of a lot of logistics that needs to be involved to make sure that it is equal playing field for 1,000 dogs on the trail. That, I think, is going to be what takes the most work. So that's sort of the mushers' outlook of it, and, of course, your side of it with the fans' perspective of it. So I think it's going to be interesting.
Yes. I just wanted to make one additional short point, which is that each race has slightly different rules. So clearly, there are some substances like you know, anabolic steroids, which I would expect would be banned from every race. But then there are other races where they might ban a certain type of pain reliever, and other races where they might not. And there are some things that might be banned in Iditarod that would be allowed in, you know, like the Cusco races. So it's going to be the sort of thing where teams are going to have to be much more aware of what the rules are for a specific race and when the rules are different for certain races. And I don't know how long some of these substances would stay in the body, but I would guess that you'd want to be looking at what the rules are for all of the races in your racing season so that you make sure that you're not using something that's allowed early on but then maybe isn't allowed in Iditarod because you don't know how long it would stay in the body and you don't want to get caught with that, you know,
That's a great point. That's a great point,
yeah.
Alex. You know, the race season here in Alaska with the qualifying races and the races that happen before Iditarod typically start in early January, and then, of course, Iditarod is just about 2 months later. So if you think about drugs in the human body where marijuana stays there, I think it's like 45 days, 30 days, something like that, stays in the human body, then, of course, other drugs, cocaine and methamphetamine and, you know, all of those others have different lengths of time that they stay in the body. It's interesting that if one of those pain relievers is allowed in, like, the Kinnick 200, which is really the first race up here in our racing season, which typically happens the first weekend of January, if that is allowed in that race and that substance stays in for, you know, a month, 3 weeks, whatever, in the body, like marijuana does in the human body, that could really change up a strategy now for how these dogs are treated for the entire race season. And I just don't know enough about, you know, pharmacology to know how long, you know, Advil stays in your system compared to steroids, compared to something else. But I think that people are really going to be on their toes now. And I know we're way over on time. Typically, we're a half-hour show, and I think the radio station is going to be a little upset with us for going over so long. But these are very important topics that we should talk about, and I highly encourage folks that are listening in to comment as well, especially from a fan's perspective. What are your guys' thoughts now that we have sort of this new Iditarod upon us here coming up in 2018. You can always reach out to us on Facebook at our Facebook page. We're on at Dogworks Radio. You can also find us on Twitter. We're pretty active there. Our show page is at Dogworks Radio. Alex is on Twitter at Coldfoot Films, and I am at Robert Forto. We would love to hear from you guys and talk a little bit more about this because this is something that I think is going to be in the news at least until the start of the Iditarod, which is in about 140-odd days or so. So it's definitely a topic that will be talked a lot about, not only up here in Alaska, with, but just about everywhere else. Alex, anything else that you want to say in closing? I am looking very forward to our upcoming series on the Serum Run, which we're going to start recording here in about a month. Anything else you want to say before we go?
You know, just that this is, we are cursed to live in interesting times in a lot of ways, and the Iditarod and Mushing is no exception, and it is going to be very interesting to see how this all plays out, you know, over the next few months and over the next few years.
Right. Well, again, thank you very much for listening, guys. We really appreciate it. And on behalf of my co-host, Alex Stein, I appreciate you being here on here as always. And my name is Robert Forto for DogWorks Radio. Make sure you head on over to Apple Podcasts and leave us a review. We would really appreciate it. It helps out on our rankings. And hit that subscribe button. You will not regret it, especially for our upcoming shows. We have a lot of them planned. I'm doing lots of interviews with some really interesting mushers, some up-and-coming mushers who I'm sure everybody follows on social media, and you'll be interested in hearing those stories. Alex, take care and stay safe from the fires, okay?
All right. I'll talk to you soon.
Did you know that Alaska Dog Works trains service dogs for those in need throughout North America? Each and every service dog that is trained through the Lead Dog Service Dog Program and Michelle Forto and her team has an individual training plan. We train for autistic, mobility, psychiatric, and PTSD for our soldiers for service work. If you know of someone that may need a service dog, please take a moment and check out Alaska Dog Works on social media and at AlaskaDogWorks.com.
If you like our podcast, there are a few things you can do. You can take a couple of minutes and go to Apple Podcasts and leave us a 5-star review. You can also check out all of our DogWorks Radio sponsors and promotions in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go over to Facebook, like our Facebook page, and one last thing, please tell all of your friends by spreading the word about DogWorks Radio. Thank you so much for listening to us. We really appreciate you.
DogWorks Radio is produced by Robert Forto. Logo art by Angry Squirrel Studios. DogWorks Radio is produced in conjunction with KVRF 89.7 in Palmer, Alaska.
For dog training advice, you can contact Alaska DogWorks at 907-841-1686. Or visit their website at AlaskaDogWorks.com. If you have a show idea or would like to be a guest, please contact us by sending an email to live@DogWorksRadio.com.